darkest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Green Lantern's Light. My name is Michael Bradley.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
I'm Javid Weider.
If you're new to the show, the premise of this podcast is pretty simple in that we are looking at Green Lantern adventures beginning in 1983 and working our way forward. If this happens to be your first episode, it's actually a really great jumping on point, as this episode we are embarking on a brand new era for the main Green Lantern books with a look at issues 187, 188, and 189. Those issues bring on a new creative team that will carry us through the next 3 years worth of books, I think it is, or even longer in the case of the artist, and we get a new editor who will be around for about 6 years, as far as the books are concerned.
Yay, excellent. Did you call yourself Javid?
It was a joke from an episode of Michael's show, Legends of the Batman, in which Michael Kaiser, my co-host on New 52 Adventures of Superman, called me Javid Weider, and they decided that was my name, so I'm owning it.
Okay, fair enough. I was just thinking to myself, you know, did you have a good St. Patrick's Day, and this is the remnants of it?
Was that no. Legends of the Batman, or was that when Charlie was on my show?
Legends of the Batman. Okay. I listened to it yesterday.
Oh, okay.
All right, Javid, thank you for that.
Okay.
Javid is a new J-Lo.
Also, when those books were published, the first three issues of Crisis on Infinite Earths were published. We're not going to be covering them a whole lot. David and Jeffrey are kind of going to talk about that a minute.
Yeah, we got to talking and looking at the books themselves, and really, Crisis did not affect Green Lantern too much. And in terms of the actual publication dates, it would have been confusing to cover them by publication date.
Yeah, I completely agree, because when I was reading through these three issues, nothing of it had to do with the first three issues of Crisis on Infinite Earths. And so I just figured that we will talk about it eventually, but it'll more be like a brief overview, because it's not really the party that we're throwing here.
Right.
And yeah, we don't see any occurrences to that for another two episodes, so...
So if you came here for Crisis on Infinite Earths, we're sorry. Just come back in two episodes. But stick around for this one.
Yeah, stick around. This is actually a good one.
Yeah.
But if you haven't read Crisis on Infinite Earths, you really should.
And now you have 2 months to do it.
Yep.
Right.
And 2 months to make the flow chart of all the characters that pop up. Have fun with that.
So the first issue we're going to be looking at this time is Green Lantern issue 187, which was released around January 17th, 1985. It had 32 pages and cost 75 cents. Our cover is by Paris Collins and Romeo Tangal, and our 17-page lead story is called A Day in His Life. Credits are Paul Kupperberg, writer, Bill Willingham, penciler, Rich Rankin, inker, Helen Vesic, letterer, Anthony Tallon, colorist, and Andy Helfer, editor. As our story opens, the entire cast, except for Jake, who is conspicuously absent, prepares to leave the cemetery following the funeral for Richard Davis. After Hal recaps how Richard was killed, saving the solar jet from Eclipso, and how it should have been him, Carol gets on Hal's case for not being himself ever since he resigned from the Green Lantern Corps, and the two head home. Mr. Smith shows up at the cemetery and gets an earful from Carl Ferris, Bruce Gordon, and John Stewart for being evil or something, and when the three men return to Ferris' Air, Bruce tells Carl that after all that's happened, the shadow of Eclipso is too strong and that he'll be leaving his position with Ferris. When Hal and Carol arrive home, Carol chews Hal out again and slams the door in his face, so Hal heads downstairs where he's apparently living. Meanwhile, back at Ferris Air, feeling rather uninspired, John charges his ring and heads out for a little patrolling as Green Lantern. Back at Carol's bungalow, Carol thinks how she treated Hal and wonders exactly what got into her when she's confronted by the Predator, who says that he just wanted to see her again. Carol tells the Predator that she's not interested, but the Predator persists. However, before he can move in, Hal, having heard the commotion, busts in for the save, only to be used as a punching bag by the Predator. Carol pleads with the Predator to let Hal be, and the Predator obliges, kisses Carol, and then leaves, saying he'll be back. Soon.
I'll be back.
As Carol checks on the bruised and bloodied Hal, we cut to John, high in the sky above Los Angeles. John's ring alerts him to some trouble out in space, so he heads up and discovers the Space Shuttle Champion in a free spin. John tries to stabilize his ship with a ring-generated clamp, but only ends up damaging the exterior of the ship. As John tries to think of what to do next, one of the astronauts begins a spacewalk to repair the ship. John generates a lasso, but isn't able to concentrate enough, and the construct snaps, sending John tumbling through space. By the time John returns to the ship, the astronaut has been able to repair the ship herself, and with the backup system firing, the shuttle has righted itself and is continuing on its way. Realizing he's got to make sure something like that never happens again, John heads to Oa and asks the Guardians for the name of the previous ring bearer in order that he can get some pointers on using the ring. Though the Guardians refuse to give him the name of the previous Lantern, they agree that some training is in order, and that, say, one of the current lanterns has been selected to be his trainer. Katmatui, Green Lantern of Korugar.
Do you mind if I start on this one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I do want to start by saying that I really enjoyed the Ween Gibbons era, but getting into this, we actually don't have the new team yet. What we have here is Kupperberg, who I really like, Paul Kupperberg, and Bill Willingham does the art. Now, Bill Willingham I kind of find to be hit or miss, and this one is both hit and miss, I felt.
I agree completely. That was one of my notes.
Because there are some really good panels and then some panels that just feel weird. But I'll get into that a little bit more in the notes. But I'm just guessing that the new team wasn't quite ready to take the reins on yet. I'm not really sure what happened there. Because this really is the beginning of this new era.
Yes.
Because this is going to continue into the next couple of issues as well. So beginning with page one. There's this comment, I hate this kind of thing. Rich went out the way he wanted to. He died a hero. What is he, a Klingon? I mean, if it were me, I'd rather be alive. I mean, if I had to die, I guess that's how you do it. But I hate it when people say that kind of thing. But anyway, I digress.
They seem to be singing his praises very highly, given that he assaulted Hal and basically stole the jet.
Well, he is dead, and there is that whole thing, you don't speak ill of the dead, you
right,
talk about the positive things of him, but I just hate that kind of comment, and I don't know, like if somebody close to me died and somebody came up and tried to say something that was reassuring, but it came out like that, I'd punch him in the face twice. Not really, but page two. And Carl Ferris has officially had enough of Agent Smith's stuff. He is not, they do not like Smith, understandably so. I mean, but he hasn't done anything that's really that evil just yet.
Yeah.
He's getting there, though.
Except for finance the rebuilding of Ferris Air, which is,
yes, that's all that he's done.
That's what I was, that was my note is, he has no real reason to go off, even though the man's blatantly evil. He couldn't be more evil unless he was wearing a clown mask and driving a windowless van around an elementary school.
Yeah, really the only thing that he's done is he smells funny. I don't know. Page four, it is sad to see Bruce Gordon go. I'm not sure that there may be one or two, but I don't think that we see him again until the Eclipso annuals crossover.
I could not tell you for sure.
Unless there's one or two one-off stories where he happens to show up, I believe that's the case. So, interesting. Page 5. Okay, Carol's having a rough couple of days, but that's no excuse for acting this way.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that people deal with grief in different ways, but come on. She just is awful to Hal here, and it's really uncalled for, unnecessary, and if she wants to be alone, she can say, I need to be alone. Again, she is going through a little bit of grief. Not horribly so. It's not like she and Rich were super close or anything, but still. But I won't harp on that any farther. Page 6. I can't believe that John Stewart went to work after the funeral, like the same day. And when he changes into Green Lantern, here's one of my problems with the art. He's drawn with what looks like Sinestro's body.
I had a note on that too. Did he just lose weight?
He suddenly lost like half of his muscle mass. I mean, he's still ripped, but... And he just doesn't look quite right. That's all that it comes down to. And he does mess up the oath, which is actually kind of forgivable since he is new to it, I guess.
He does. He says
in brightest day and darkest night. Yep. Page 8. So Hal is going to be eating dinner by himself. So what's he going to have? Hormel chili with beans, a.k.a. bachelor food.
Well, it beats Green Arrow's chili. At least he's not going to be basically giving dysentery from chili.
I would totally eat Green Arrow's chili. My wife would love it, at least. So by page 9 and 10, when Predator is just throwing Hal around, I wish that Hal at least put up a slightly better fight than this. But then again, I don't know who Predator is, and don't tell me. So, page 13, Betamax.
Yes.
John compares how his ring works to Betamax, because the picture is better with his ring, which is very, very amusing to me. And for any youngsters out there who don't know, Betamax was like HD DVD. They were trying it out. It was in competition with VHS and VHS 1. VHS are videotapes. There probably will be some young people who don't know what I'm talking about unless I say that. So, very well. And plenty of older people who are like, look, we know. Page 14, I like that John is still learning the ropes and messing up some. And, of course, the whole point of this is that it's his impetus to go to Oa. And I think this might be his first time in space. He does make a mention of that on page 13. And my final note is, let me find it real quick. On page 17, there's a little bit of a typo. It looks like there's a word missing when the Guardian is speaking to John. We concur, my son, but we not compromise the past Green Lantern's new life thus. I think it's supposed to be we will not compromise.
Letterer ran out of space.
Not a big deal, but for a podcast, I thought I would mention it.
He's a bizarro. We not compromise the past.
He's Yoda.
I guess I'm next. I started with the cover because with this, it's John. I mean, it's the whole John saving the shuttle thing. I'm less interested in the action and more on how dynamic John looks because he's sleek, but he doesn't look as thin as he did. You know, where Jeffrey and I mentioned down the line where he just seems to have dropped pounds. And the pupilless eyes, those eye holes, like the wider they get, the cooler they are. And I'm like, why do I like this so much? Oh, Romeo Tengal, one of my favorite Green Lantern artists. So that fits. And we won't see him regularly for kind of a while.
Yeah,
I believe. Yeah. My notes, beginning with page 4, Bruce Gordon leaving. We're starting to see some of the cast that we've dealt with for the last year or so starting to dwindle down as the book begins to shift towards a different direction. And it's kind of – we're starting to see some of these plot lines wrap up in a way. And it's kind of – Englehart's not coming in and just saying, I'm going to wipe the slate clean, forget what Ween did. He's really doing it in a very organic way, because it doesn't feel unnatural for Bruce Gordon to leave.
Yeah, it was the same thing when in the 70s and even early 80s when a new creative team would come on Spider-Man.
And they would just integrate their what they want to do with what was media res at the time.
Yeah. And in fact, when let's see, geez, I'm blanking on names at the moment. When who was the artist in Amazing Spider-Man?
Ditko?
I was thinking of the one after that.
I'm Romita.
Blanking on his name. Yeah, John Romita. When John Romita came on after Ditko, he actually was trying to draw like Ditko at first, not to try and copy him, but so that there would be a smooth transition, so that it would slowly become John Romita's style.
Mm-hmm.
That and way so I think that's kind of what we're getting here story-wise, which I really appreciate, rather than just, okay, that's over, these people are gone, like they do now.
Yeah. Yeah, and it works really well. I was really happy to see that. And I'm kind of on the other side of the equation, although I don't know who's the bigger jerk. Carol is acting like a witch, but Hal's just not getting the hint that she does want to be left alone when it's kind of right there on the billboard. But my main note was, what is the deal with everybody's face? Willingham is a better artist than this. I mean, he came up through D&D book covers. And those look more Barry Windsor Smith. So I wonder if it's him trying to – well, no, because I saw him when he was doing Elementals at Comico. And that was when I was doing those early stages of discovering, oh, there's other people who put out comics beyond Marvel and DC.
That's he was doing that right around the same time that this came out.
Okay.
It's that also kind of possible – It does occur to me when it's a fill-in issue like this, which, I mean, this is still telling the ongoing story and doing a good job of it, but it is still in a lot of ways a fill-in issue just because of the creative team, because the new creative team has not really started just yet. I'm wondering if maybe this had to be a bit of a rush job.
Maybe. But his art in Elementals was, I wouldn't say rough, it was very unpolished. But I wouldn't go as far as to say rough.
Like, I have tended to find him hit or miss a lot of the time. Not so much in the past decade. I think that he's pretty much hitting on all cylinders lately. But I've always kind of thought, oh, this is awesome. Oh, this is not so awesome. But it tends to be issue specific, at least in my experience. And in this case, we're getting some hits and some misses within the issue.
True. And yeah, and he's really polished himself since then. But Hal here looks like his face looks like badly cooked mashed potatoes. But I think
properly cooked mashed potatoes.
Oh, true, yeah.
Or or a meatloaf shaped like a baby.
But hold on, you just totally threw me off.
Sorry,
it's okay. I think you're correct in that he is trying to go a little bit more Dave Gibbons than his own style, though. I can see that. Moving to page 9, this is where I realized that the identity of the Predator probably hasn't been decided yet. And I don't know if Ween had a plan in place that was disregarded, but when we do get that revelation, it does feel like more of a retcon of long-term story planning. And this is sort of some of the things that I can't really go into details. We'll come back to that when we get that revelation. But it's a little bit, oh, okay, you had no idea at this time, did you?
It can't be any worse than Monarch and Armageddon 2001. You are familiar with that story,
yes,
right?
I know. It was supposed to be Captain Atom, and it ended up being Hawk. I'm trying to figure out if it's worse or not. Well, we'll get there.
I don't know, because I don't know who it's going to turn out to be.
Yeah. I'm actually curious to see your opinion at that point. If it's anything like, well, that episode hasn't hit. Never mind. I was going to mention the Fantastic Cast, but I'm like, oh yeah, that's not until May.
There is a moment in the next issue where it occurred to me, is it Pie Face? But then no, I thought, aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?
Oh, speaking of movie references, page 11. I immediately thought of Superman 2. I'm surprised you didn't have this note, Jeffrey. So later down the line, Hal's going to walk into a diner where the Predator is berating the staff and throw him into a pinball machine.
Been working out.
Working out. page 14, like Jeffrey, I like that John is making mistakes. He's human. And we're looking with a very unreal scenario where somebody's been handed a Green Lantern ring. They're not going to jump in with all the answers, even with the limited experience he actually does have.
I would.
Well, you're Jeffrey Taylor. But why is John's glove yellow in panel 6? Or is that just my copy?
No, it's yellow in mine too.
Okay. That's something that
it's sort of a similar color to the rest of the aura, and there were plenty of times early on in Green Lantern I was taking a look at some of the earlier ones where the green actually looks yellow because of the coloring process they were using at the time. And I don't know if maybe
yellow, blue make green.
Well, there's that. Yeah. But I wonder if it's actually supposed to be because the ring is on that hand. I don't know.
That maybe the R would be stronger at the source.
Oh, no, it's left hand.
Never mind.
Is John left-handed?
No, it's the ring is on the wrong hand, this issue. The whole issue.
Okay.
I hadn't heard about
that. I'd not picked up on that before, but I'm looking at this now. I'm like, wait a second. Why is it on his left hand?
Yeah.
It's always on his right hand.
Because he's married to the core. I don't know. Page 16. It makes sense that John wouldn't just idly accept that he has to learn how to wield the ring on his own. John is assertive, but he's not going to shy away from telling the Guardians that they're just full of it if they're going to hand him the most powerful weapon of the universe and not include at least an instruction manual. So I am glad he said, look, this is crap.
Or so you've decided to become a Green Lantern pamphlet.
Yeah. There you go. Can we have those made? That would be great. Finally, page 17, John Stewart and Kat Matui teaming up. I'm sure nothing will ever, ever come of that. She'll teach him and go on her own merry way. Oh, wait. No, overall, this really could have been one of the other goofy fill-ins we've had so far. Or, you know, maybe more like an reapplied reprint. But I do feel we actually got a relevant story. And the issue, the story didn't go off the rails. There were some slightly out of character beats like Ferris, but if you were casually reading the issue, you wouldn't notice that Len Wein was completely absent. However, you would notice that Dave Gibbons was gone. But
yes.
Yeah. Despite some rough patches in terms of character details and some awkward faces, the story got told. The layouts were solid. And so far, this transition to the new creative team kind of ends up being fairly seamless. As seamless as it can be.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's all I got. Michael.
You guys actually hit quite a few of my notes. On pages 2 to 5, I'll agree with Jeffrey here. I'm not really digging Carol's attitude towards Hal. I can excuse some grief, whether it's over Clay's accident or Richard's death, but at this point it's getting harder and harder to excuse her attitude. On page 6, on a more positive note, it's nice seeing John doing a little bit of the architect thing. It's only a couple panels, you know, basically long enough for him to throw his pen down in frustration, but it's still nice to see him working at his civilian job since we haven't seen that. Pages 7 through 11, I didn't really care for this scene with the Predator and Carol and Hal. I'm sure it was to come off as a serious scene, but it just left me cold. I thought the dialogue was bad, and the Predator comes off as silly and not menacing or threatening at all. And there's no reason Hal shouldn't have broken his neck when the Predator just threw him across the room and into the desk. Page 11 was okay. The emotion on Carol's face in the first panel and the chilling way the Predator, you know, he just beat the stuffing out of Hal in one panel and then was just very calm the next, and then Hal's battered face in the last panel. So,
sorry about that.
That's
animals.
Right.
Rawhide. Animals,
cats and dogs living together.
Yeah.
Mass hysteria. Sorry.
So the end was good, but the rest I thought needed work. Page 12, I got a laugh out of John's comment about patrolling being boring and his Superman reference. I kind of like that. And then on page 17, I kind of find it neat that John doesn't know that Hal is the former Lantern, and I look forward to the story or the issue when he finds out, because I've never read that. I'm pretty sure it happens in a book that we'll be covering before the end of the year, so I look forward to reading that. And
before the end of the comic book year, you mean, right? Or before the
I meant before the end of 2012, but
oh, okay.
It
wow.
could be before the end of 85. I don't really know. Like I said, I've never read that issue.
I don't know
issue.
What happened. Yeah.
And given the interaction between Katman and John in 185, it's interesting that the Guardians chose her. We don't really get a direct follow-up to that, but the direction their relationship goes, even by the end of the books we're looking at this issue, it kind of casts the tension between them and the original meeting in a somewhat different light. But that's all I had that you guys didn't hit. I had issues with the art in this story, like you guys did. Many of the characters just look weird, or like John and the Predator both look very scrawny compared to how Gibbons drew them. And at the end, Kat Matui looks... She looks very scrawny, too, and her eyes in that last panel look completely soulless.
She looks like Aunt May. Like, you could take that face and not make it bright neon pink, and... Oh, well.
But like you guys, I would like to know why Paul Kupperberg wrote this issue, since it deals with trying to tie up loose ends from Ween's run and setting things up for Steve Englehart. You know, even though it's a fill-in, it's not... It's a fill-in creative team, but it's not a fill-in issue because you couldn't just jump from 185 to 187 and it wouldn't make sense in the narrative. So
it may have been just where the scripting fell and they're like, okay, Englehart's not full-on yet, because we've had the weird fill-in issues with the Guy Gardner reprint and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think Englehart was ramping up. He's like, okay, I got an idea for where I need to start. Can you point A to point B it for me?
Could be. Yeah.
Of course, we also got a new editor,
usually,
too.
Yeah, that usually does end up being the story when we're able to get in touch with an editor or one of the writers. That 9 times out of 10, that's what ends up being the story. So that's why I feel comfortable guessing that. But again, it could be a different story altogether. So who knows?
Yeah. So our second story is a 6-page Tales of the Green Lantern Corps backup, and it's titled Forever Blowing Bubbles. It was reprinted in Best of DC Digest number 71 and Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Volume 2 trade paperback. Credits are Mike Barron, writer, drawn by Marshall Rogers, lettered by Ben Oda, colored by Anthony Tolan, and edited by Len Wein. As our story opens, we meet KT-21, housewife, mother, glassblower, Green Lantern. KT promises to buy her son some more plastiglass next time she's at the store. And it's explained later that plastiglass is a malleable plastic that they give to kids to practice glass blowing. She then hears an emergency broadcast that the warlord Pommel and his band of space pirates are looting the central store. KT charges her ring and heads out as Green Lantern, and when she arrives at the store, she grabs a tube of red plastiglass from a spilled display to give to her son, and then comes across an injured security guard who warns her about Pommel's cleverness. KT makes her way to the penthouse, where Pommel is supervising the store looting, but is caught in a trap and imprisoned inside a nearly indestructible yellow bubble.
Where have I seen that before?
Right. After a monologue from Pommel, he prepares to launch, and KT pulls out the plastiglass and blows a bubble big enough for her to fit inside. Once inside, she continues to blow to increase the size of the bubble until it gets so big that it shatters the yellow bubble. Now free, KT captures Pommel and his pirates, and then returns home with dozens of tubes of plastiglass for her son, given to her on the house by the store. The end.
Actually, what is this, Scarecrow and Mrs. King? Is this Murder, She Wrote in Space? It's like some bad toy commercial for a piece of crap that you can get in the bargain area of the local dollar store in the day of saved blowing bubbles. I'm just waiting for the Hostess fruit pies to get stolen.
Pretty much.
You get a big delight in every bite.
It's kind of a cute story. There are parts of it that really don't make a whole lot of sense, and I'll talk about that in just a second. Right there on page 2, she shows up at the mall, or the central store, but it's basically a mall. You can see that two of the stores are called Spacey's and Nichols, as in Macy's and Penny's.
Oh,
I didn't. Which I... It's like, oh, come on. Page 4, I love the design for this pink bad guy. I mean, you can just tell that he's bad news, especially with that mustache.
And the mohawk?
Well, the mohawk is supposed to make him look even worse, but I think it would have been fine with just the mustache. But anyway, I digress. Well, you have to try really hard to make yourself look badass when your skin is pink. Just saying.
Yeah.
As far as the yellow bubble itself goes, yeah, Sinestro did the exact same thing to Hal in their first meeting. We talked about that in the first episode of Green Lantern's Light. But my question is, once she's blowing up the red plastic glass, and then she gets inside so that she can then blow it up the rest of the way, where is the new air coming from? Because she's got to stop and inhale so that she can then blow through that tube thing to continue to blow it up. But every time she inhales, isn't she, you know, taking the air out of it?
Maybe she willed it to happen with her ring. She willed new oxygen to come into being.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But
yeah, it's sort of a physics problem, but again, it's kind of a cute, silly story, so I'm willing to forgive that. And on page 6, I did not notice on the first couple of pages, because it's either covered up or it's too small to see, the kid is wearing a Superman shirt.
Uh-huh. I thought that was neat. You can see it on the front page, but it's kind of small, so it's not real detailed, so I can see how you missed it.
Yeah, or it's covered by their pet in one of the panels.
Oh, right, yeah.
But that's all I have on this one. David.
Oh, that you heard mine. That was all I just,
okay.
I just started reading it. I started trying to take it seriously, and I'm like, no, I'm out. I'm just out.
I felt that way about the last backup we're going to be talking about.
Yeah. My first reaction to this was, so this is what Green Lantern is like. It's a sitcom. I did think it was cute, but it just felt very out of place here. It felt more like a story appropriate to a Green Lantern comic aimed at very young children, which DC has never had. But it wasn't bad. It just seemed out of place, and it left me wondering why, out of all the possibilities for ideas for Tales of the Green Lantern Corps backups, why this one was chosen as presumably one of the best.
This is basically, yeah, remember back when they were thinking about making a Green Lantern movie as a comedy with Jack Black?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sadly.
This is that.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. I would have rather seen the Jack Black thing than what we got.
Just really?
I just walked out.
You'd rather see it as a comedy like The Mask?
Yeah, I walked out of the Green Lantern movie completely numb. At least with the Jack Black, I would have hated it or laughed.
Okay. I still enjoyed the Green Lantern movie. I didn't love it, but I did enjoy it. I'm glad that I own it on Blu-ray.
Oh, that was just a side note. Sorry.
Yeah. I sincerely hope they make a sequel, although I don't think it's going to happen at this point.
To the Green Lantern movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
They didn't make their money back.
I think we would have heard that they were working on it already. Even if it's just an announcement that says, hey, we're going to write one. But
it did worse than Superman Returns as far as actual profit.
I had not heard that. Wow.
Well, Superman Returns internationally made a profit.
Green Lantern did not make its money back in the theaters. It may have done a little bit better with the DVD release. I don't know for sure. But it's still not enough to warrant doing a sequel. Superman Returns did make money, if you count both the domestic and the international box offices.
Right, right.
Squeezed out a little bit, but that's about it.
It got more than $100 million. I can't remember what the actual numbers were.
I blame Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, well, I blame Bryan Singer.
Touché.
There's no letters page in this issue. Instead, we get previews to the covers of Justice League of America number... I have 23 in my notes, but it's 237. And The Flash number 344, which is odd since Green Lantern appears in neither book. But we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Jeffrey will tell us about Green Lantern issue 188.
My name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
and we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
Can't do that. He can't reveal his secret identity.
Too late, Hal. He just did. Exactly. Sorry, I was trying to compliment you.
This was titled Decent Exposure for the main story. There is a backup as well, but you've never heard of it. So the cover date for this was May 1985, came out February 21st, 1985. The credits, since we have the new creative team finally getting going, Steve Englehart is the writer, Joe Staton penciler, Bruce Patterson inker, Helen Vesick letterer, Tony Tallon colorist, and Andy Helfer editor, who is the new editor on that. I like Andy Helfer a lot. And the cover is actually by Staton and, who was the inker on this? Patterson. So actually the exact same as the interior. So there you go. To recap, Tawny Young makes a news report that outs Jon Stewart as Green Lantern. It seems that a number of people had already seen his face and learned his name during his previous escapades while he wasn't wearing the mask. She even interviews a few of the previous witnesses, as well as Superman and Green Arrow. Hal and Carol have been watching this in shock, but Hal realizes that Jon didn't wear a mask before because he never really seemed to care. But Hal still reassures Carol that he's happy with his decision to quit the Corps. Next, he gets a phone call from Green Arrow, who was not happy about this. Tawny had interviewed him, but Ollie had no idea that the subject was actually about outing John's secret identity. Hal says that it's okay and that he's happy with not being Green Lantern, which makes Ollie think that Hal's only happy when he's really screwed up. So he may have a point there, even though it's kind of weird. Instead of getting upset by this, Hal decides that it's time to track down this predator jerk who's been threatening and hitting on Carol. Meanwhile, in Burbank, Tawny receives a promotion from the network for breaking this story. Not sure that scene really goes anywhere or does anything important. Out in space, John and Cat Matui are returning to Earth from Oa. John was able to use his ring to catch the TV signal, and he knows what's going on. He complains to Katma that he was never really trained for this job, so he's unsure how to police an entire sector of space. But then again, that's why Katma is there. He hopes that she'll tell him the secret identity of the old Green Lantern, but she says that if the Guardians wouldn't do it, she can't either. He also explains that he never really planned to be Green Lantern all the time like this, so he wasn't exactly sitting around waiting for his next mission, since he was only needed once a year. But this was not exactly something that he was planning on. In order to blend in, Katma Tui uses her ring to alter the appearance of her skin color to be more like John's, which makes John start getting a tingle in his britches. The Encinal Canyon, in Encinal Canyon, which is a place I'm guessing in California, I don't know if it's real or not, Sonar, Master of Sound, gets it into his head that he should attack the new Green Lantern in order to make his small home country of Madora more famous. There's a few panels of Tom Pieface Kalmaku returning home as well, and apparently he doesn't watch TV. That's all that we learn in that scene. The next day at Ferris Aircraft, Hal realizes that what the Predator seems to the Predator seems to know a lot about the company, Ferris Aircraft, so he must have worked there. So Hal starts going through the personnel files. Tom passes by and gives him the stink eye without saying anything. And then Hal hears some commotion outside. He lifts the blinds and sees John Stewart getting out of his car with Katma in disguise. All the workers come by and congratulate him, but Carol walks up and says that she's going to have to lay him off. She doesn't want the company associated with a Green Lantern in any way. He had done a great job, but this is too much, and he could draw as much negative attention as positive. Hal walks up, prompting the disguised Katma Tui to grab him and force him into some tonsil hockey. John takes her away, saying, "This is Katrina, a cat. She's from Nigeria." Yeah. Soon Hal is explaining to Carol who she really is and that she's upset with him for quitting the Corps. And at the same time, Katma Tui is lying to John, saying that she was just taking revenge for Carol firing him by making out with her boyfriend. Right. They're about to leave the building in the airfield when an explosion knocks down the outer wall. It's Sonar. Yay. And John's pissed since he just rebuilt that place. He turns into Green Lantern but tells Katma to stay incognito. He flies up to meet Sonar but is knocked back down. John flies at him faster than the speed of sound and knocks Sonar down. Next, Sonar throws some steel I-beams at John, but he deflects them. Sonar uses sound waves to create some turbulence, so John has an idea that Katma Tui should stay hidden, but use her ring to create sound waves at Sonar while he does the same from the other side. The resulting effect is that the waves will cancel each other out when they're hitting him, so all John has to do is skip a beat, and in that way it will actually throw him off. Sonar falls out of the sky and he's knocked unconscious. Tawny Young has arrived and tries to catch a quick interview, but she calls him John. And he says, "Tawny, when I'm dressed like this, it's not John, it's Green Lantern." And Hal says, "Well, that's enough of that," and he goes back to looking through personnel files.
you sound like you have a lot to say, Michael.
Do you care if I go first on this one?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. I don't really have page by page. I just had a lot of... I was kind of frustrated with this issue. I mean, I know it's Englehart's first, and I hate to be harsh on it because he's trying to deal with leftover threads from Lynn Wein and go off on his own direction. But I'm just going to kind of throw my problems out there and then maybe you guys can tackle them when you're page by page. In issue 182, John said Carol introduced him to Hal. Now, on page 4, we're reminded that Hal recommended John to Carol, apparently leaving out the bit that he was his Green Lantern substitute. Then over on pages 10 and 11, John finds out that Hal recommended him for the job. It's just odd that none of this came up before. I mean, it's odd that Hal wouldn't tell Carol how he knew John, and it's odd that Carol wouldn't mention that Hal had recommended him. It's just all very strange. Katma Tui is absolutely insane throughout this entire issue. She's clearly still got a grudge against Hal for resigning from the Corps, and is even willing to torpedo his relationship with Carol just to get back with him. or to get back at him. On page 8, Tom Kalmaku arrives home. Tom Kalmaku doesn't watch TV. Tom Kalmaku listens to Joy Division. Tom Kalmaku cuts himself to feel. Seriously, I don't know what his problem is here. I mean, maybe we'll get some more of this down the road. It certainly doesn't come up again next issue. But I don't know if this is something Englehart is carrying over from Ween's run. None of us liked it when Ween brought it up, so unless Englehart is actually going somewhere with it, I just assume they drop it. But I guess we will see.
No, Tom, it's my life. I'm not going to ask your opinion when I need to make a major life decision.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you have some sand in your vagina.
The revelation of John's ID, I actually don't mind that. In fact, I like it because it sets him apart from Hal. The problem I have is everyone being so nonchalant about it on page 2, and then John's lack of reaction to Tawny on page 17. Because you'd think he'd have a bit more of a reaction to a woman who he was clearly shown to have feelings for, revealing the biggest his biggest secret and completely changing his life on national television.
I think that would have been in the voice tone, which doesn't come across on the printed page, but
okay.
It's like, I'm Green Lantern. Deal with it.
I do get the sense, and Hal even says this, that John didn't really seem to care. And since he's just been thrust into being Green Lantern full time, maybe he just figures, well, I guess I should wear the mask if I want to live any sort of a life. But I don't know that it matters to him that much. But then, of course, when he gets laid off, then he has a reason to be kind of mad at Tawny. Like, you know, you cost me my job. That's not cool, lady.
Yeah. A bright side is, I guess, the retroactive special.
I'm dating a real woman now.
Right. The retroactive special that we'll be covering in a couple weeks does deal with that, but it's very much a revisionist telling of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't tie in the same way that some of the other retroactive ones did, where it was like a new chapter. It was more of a retelling in a new way.
But that's all I had. I do feel bad. I don't have more positive things to say. I hate to just tear this apart because that's not what this podcast is about, and it's a brand new creative team, but there was just a lot of stuff here that wasn't great and not so much that was praiseworthy. Hopefully I'll have more positive things to say once Englehart moves on to what he wants to do rather than, you know, wrapping up stuff from Ween's run.
Well, let me go ahead and go through my notes. Starting with the cover again, this is a cover that I distinctly remember seeing as a kid on the rack at a local convenience store. And, you know, way back in the first episode, you'll remember that I said, you know, I would pop in and not know anything about it. I was really confused with this cover because I knew next to nothing about Green Lantern. I think I was about 7 years old, maybe younger, beyond what Super Friends taught me. And suddenly he didn't look like the Green Lantern from the Super Friends anymore, and he's revealing his secret identity. So this cover oddly stood out through the test of time. So when we got to this issue, I'm like, oh, that one.
While we're on the cover, does this woman in the lower right look like Jeanette Kahn to anyone else?
I was wondering that, actually.
Let me roll back up to it.
And I'm not sure necessarily who any of the other ones are, but there is one guy who looks like Quark from Next Generation in Deep Space Nine.
The one with the Ferris aircraft paddle?
Yes.
That looks like it could be Bridwell next to Jeanette Kahn. An older Bridwell.
Could be. E. Nelson Bridwell?
Mm-hmm.
Was he
we could just be seeing things.
Was he still with DC at this time, E. Nelson Bridwell?
I am not
sure.
Yeah,
well, he died in 1987, according to Wikipedia, so. But I don't know when he retired. But you're right, that does it with a little less hair, yeah. Anyway, carry on.
Sorry. It's ironic that the cover's yellow. So really, John couldn't do anything to this cover. He's powerless against this cover. Page one, I'll actually go and say that I thought this really hit the ground running as far as saying we're not going to rehash the same thing. And while they're still phasing out some of the Lin Wein stuff, this is kind of a punch in the face, really. Just, oh, no, he's John Stewart. His secret identity was revealed. Wow. And I think the speech blue says it right. Say what?
Say what?
But page 3, Superman and Green Arrow are talking about John. did I miss a crossover somewhere? Or are they just talking about him contextually, just by from what they've seen?
I'm pretty sure that it's just contextually.
Okay. Because, yeah. On the same page. Yeah, I love this. This is fantastic. It's nice that Tawny made sure to name and show video of John's mom. So next issue, Sinestro stuffs her into a fridge. Page four, Green Arrow says what we are pretty much all thinking, because he can read Hal like a book. What with those late night bonding sessions over chili. Basically, I think Ollie's the only one who really knows Hal. Better even than Carol. And I think even though Hal's putting on the brave face for everybody, even for himself, he's really trying to convince himself. And Ollie's like, nah, cut the crap. I see through you. You hate this. You're only miserable when you screw up. Which I love. I love that. That's one of my favorite friendships in comics.
Or he's only happy when he thinks he screwed up.
Or he's only happy when it's raining.
Yeah.
Page five, the Predator just hangs out on rooftops listening to secret plans being hatched.
Yeah.
Actually, well, this is actually interesting because it is a bit of a change in his attitude, because normally Predator just jumps right into the mix. So I think Englehart has already got a plan for the character. I think this is indicative of the new attitude of the character. I don't know that this... I think now that we're on the direction of, well, considering how quickly we will have this resolved, we're on the direction we need to be to really get this taken care of. And I like that Tawny got a promotion out of all this, because that's special. That really is. You stab a superhero in the back and get rewarded. I just bet she works for Fox News. Too soon?
I'm just not commenting because I don't want to get political about it. That's all.
I didn't intend to get political.
No, you're fine. I'm just saying.
I'm happy to get political. I just don't quite get exactly how it's fitting.
Fox News, any news place that has any kind of agenda or lean is not news. I'm sorry.
Right.
News is objective. So it's not political. It's news quality.
Okay.
And Tawny clearly had an agenda.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough.
So I wasn't getting political. Topical, yes, but not political.
Gotcha.
Page six, John is changing his costume via the ring, but last issue he simply had it on under his clothes.
Yeah. I'm very inconsistent about that.
Yeah. The whole skin tone thing. When Katma changes her skin tone, I always praise Kyle Rayner for his creative use of the ring, because I tend to be a Kyle Rayner apologist. But clearly, constructs are only a fraction of the power. And now I feel a bit short-sighted on my previous views of what the ring is capable of, just having gone through the issues that we have so far in this show. And I'm like, oh, wow, it's well beyond what I would have conceived.
Well, what the ring can do has changed over time, because remember, at one point it could make him – it could make Green Lantern and even other people invisible.
Mm-hmm. Entire cities.
Entire cities. And that's not something that they try to do with it now. And it does seem to be a lot more construct based, as well as certain things like an automated translator and protective shield kind of thing. But this is not something that I think it can really do at all in any of the current ones. And I think even by Kyle Rayner's time, and plus even getting rid of the yellow and impurity, in a sense,
mm-hmm. Just sort of natural evolution.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of my initiation to Green Lantern beyond Super Friends was in the Kyle Rayner era. So that's kind of the default that my mind's going to go to.
Yeah, Kyle Rayner was right when I got into Green Lantern. It was around Green Lantern number 48. So there you go.
Yep. Page 8, Sonar, just to give a little background, was last seen in Green Lantern number 130, in which he strapped Hal to a yellow missile and dropped him from a jet. And now somehow he's gotten out of prison with no explanation, only to be returned there again. And then next issue happens. It's nice to know that Thomas doesn't watch TV. I needed to know that.
It is such a weird little scene. Like, why do we even see this?
I think it's just to mention that Thomas is out there.
We're going to see him again on the next page, and he's going to actually, you know, not really do anything, but sort of do something while he's listening to his tween wave.
Yep. He's giving Hal longing looks there on page 9. Yeah.
And then he walks off to go cut himself some more.
Yep. Get some more dashboard confessional. Page 10. Now, is Carol laying John off for the reason she's saying? Because Green Lantern has been kind of somewhat related to Carol, to Ferris Aircraft, since the beginning.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly why she's laying him off, because of the negative attention that a Green Lantern draws. And even though the DTs, when they attacked, it was not specifically about Green Lantern, there have been plenty of times where somebody has attacked Ferris Aircraft because they know that Green Lantern's around there somewhere.
True. So now that
and
they've got...
I think that's actually a perfectly valid reason and a really good idea on her part. And I commend her for making that decision.
But do you think her relationship with Hal and the fact this is Hal's successor plays anything? Is she really just...
Oh.
Never mind.
I don't think so.
Retracted. I just put... Never mind. Page 11. Wow. Wow, Hal. With Cat Matui, just stick the knife in and twist it. Because now you're all happy with Carol after you tricked Cat Matui, misspelled Catman in my notes, Cat Matui into ditching her love so she could be dedicated to the core. And I know he's really not being intentional about it, but it's like, wow. From Cat Matui's point of view, it's just like, just give her the finger and be done with it.
Yeah, like I said, she's totally insane.
Yep.
And then, of course, I mean, she's almost outing Hal as being the old Green Lantern here. Especially since Carol does know who she is. And so, I mean, Hal tells Carol the truth, but then she has to lie to John Stewart because otherwise it's, well, he's the old Green Lantern.
Yeah.
And her explanation is pretty weak.
Yeah, very weak. And page 13, John's glove apparently frequently turns yellow. But I do like the idea that if it's the ring finger, maybe the aura is stronger there, but it is back on the right hand this time. And, of course, he's beefed back up since last issue.
He was working out on Oa.
Yeah. finally, page 14. I like Sonar talking about his country. He's just out of nowhere explaining the whole geography. I appreciate the lesson, Sonar, but I really think that could have been an editor's note. And Sonar, is, as I mentioned off-air, is Borat in supervillain form. He comes from the country Kazakhstan. Nice. Overall, though, I mean, this was a really good debut. I actually had more positives than negatives. Clearly, Englehart did come in with a plan and a direction that he wanted to take the book. And I think apparently the biggest weakness with Staton and his art was Hal without his mask on. And I think a lot of artists do have trouble drawing Hal without it. Because Staton, or yeah, did I say Staton? Staton actually makes Hal look like Peter Parker a lot.
Interesting. Yeah. Making a lot of Spider-Man references this episode.
It happens.
Okay, and anything else on that issue?
That's it. I'm done with that main story.
Okay. Some of the same notes that you guys had. I did enjoy this one. I really liked this issue a lot. And it is going to tie sort of into the retroactive story that we'll be talking about in the special episode. Jumping on to page 2, where we get John Stewart's mom. Wow, that's not John Stewart's mom. That's John Stewart's cross-dressing dad. John's mom is Tyler Perry.
Medea goes to Oa?
Yeah. But it's true. John wasn't masked before, and of course this is playing out a bit differently than it's going to play out in the retroactive book. But I will go ahead and say right now that I do prefer this version. I haven't read all of the earlier John Stewart appearances. Obviously, we covered the first one. But did Superman actually know him at all?
I believe that John Stewart showed up in an issue or two of Justice League.
Oh, okay, interesting.
But I don't know if Superman was in those issues. I would have to actually do some research and find out what issues those were.
Okay. Agreeing with Javid about Ollie's reaction at the end of page 4 about how Hal's only happy when he thinks that he's screwed up. It's kind of a weird thing to even think about. It's a weird thing, but I guess the point is that Ollie knows him and that we are getting definite information that even though Hal says that he's happy to Carol, that he's actually kind of miserable. So there you go.
On page 5, this guy who's promoting Tawny, here's another scene that doesn't really mean anything or go anywhere, and he's just some kind of executive news guy, and I'm just looking at him and thinking, you know, when he goes into makeup, they're like, okay, lift up your chin, okay, now your other chin, and finally that last chin. On page 6, I hadn't put that much thought into it until last issue, but it's interesting. John never did get any formal training from the Green Lantern Corps, and he's got a lot to learn. And I'm wondering why Kilowog isn't training him. Instead, he's getting Cat Matui as sort of a mentor, so to speak. Of course, you know, John's hitting on his mentor, and that's never really a good idea. But I do love this. Yeah?
Plus, Kilowog hasn't been introduced yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he doesn't come along until after Crisis.
Gotcha. Interesting. I don't know why I didn't know that. I think I used to know that, but anyway, though, it seems like he should go through some level of formal training. I do love the transformation that John goes through on the top of page 7, where he's transforming into his normal clothes. I love the transformation, but I hate the outfit. That's such an awful outfit, I've got to say. Page 8, yeah, I hate Sonar. It's just whatever. On page 9, that was the moment where I thought, is Tom the Predator? But no, he's not quite the right skin tone or the height. So what are you going to do? Page 10, I'm totally with Carol on this because Green Lantern does draw way too much negative attention. And when it comes to a company like Ferris Aircraft, it's not a popularity contest. They're not trying to get more customers to come to them because they have Green Lantern. They're a contracting company. So it's not a popularity contest where Green Lantern as a default spokesperson is really valuable. And all that Green Lantern really does there is draw negative attention. And so I'm totally with her on firing him. On page 11, my reaction to Cat Matui kissing Hal is, why did she do that? What the hell? She's awful. Page 15, Sonar's weapon really should be an easy workaround for a Green Lantern. I mean, he's dealing – it's a sonic weapon. Didn't we see Green Lanterns flying through stars? Through them, not just close to them? And so it's essentially – light travels in waves. Sound travels in larger waves. Shouldn't he be able to just stand there and be like, well, why are you pointing your tuning fork at me? Cut it out. And what John and Katma actually do to him with the sound waves that, you know, cancel each other out because they're coming from different sides, I'm not sure that that's how it works, but I'm no physicist.
I didn't necessarily know if it was the direction or just the canceling out effect.
I think that the direction is what creates the canceling out effect.
Oh, true.
And so then he's able to put like a single tiny moment where he's not sending the sound, and so it actually pushes him off course and makes him fall, and he's knocked out because he lands on his head. Maybe it'll make him smarter.
I wouldn't count on it.
Yeah, it didn't work that way for Dr. Light.
No. But that's all I got. Now, the backup story is a little-known story, maybe you've heard of it, called Mogo Doesn't Socialize. This was actually turned into one of the animated shorts on the Green Lantern Emerald Knights DVD and Blu-ray release that came out around the same time as the Green Lantern movie. It's a really good story, and well, of course it's by Alan Moore. And I'm pretty sure it's been reprinted quite a few times. But Alan Moore is the writer. Dave Gibbons is the artist. So, again, you can't go wrong there. Anthony Tallon, colorist, and Len Wein, editor. So in the beginning here, what's her name? Aresia is going through the Book of Oa, which is telling all about the various Green Lanterns of the past. And she's realizing that there are some who are members of the Corps that she has never met, and she's wondering why. And Tumar Rhee explains, you know, there are some who just don't attend meetings. For instance, Liesel Pon is a super intelligent smallpox virus. And Dickritzy-Rur does not attend meetings because he's an abstract mathematical progression. Only the Guardians notice his presence. But as for Mogo, well, Mogo doesn't socialize. And so we get this story of a guy named Bulfunga, who is a big badass character with lots of earrings, and he rides around in his ship, and he likes to cause problems by dueling people who are supposed to be really big and bad. And he had heard about Mogo, so he goes to the planet where Mogo is supposed to be, gets on his loudspeaker and says, "Okay, now you better come out. If you come out right now, I'll let you live, and you'll just have to be in suspended animation or whatever it is that it's called. But if you don't come out now, I will hunt you down and I will kill you." And nothing happens. So he starts walking into the forest. And he's like, "Okay, I'm going to come and get you." And he walks around for quite a while, can't find it. He even finds a bug and says, "Well, you don't have a Green Lantern ring." So he squishes it and moves on. And he realizes that there are these kilometers-wide clearings, and he's not entirely sure why. But since he can't find Mogo, he begins to map out the planet, essentially. And he stays there for about a year mapping out the planet until finally he's going through his charts and he says, "Wait a second. Oh no." And he runs and gets on a ship and flies away. And when he looks back, once he's in outer orbit, he realizes that that the forestry is actually in the shape of the Green Lantern symbol, and that Mogo is not a person on the planet. Mogo is the planet. And so Arisia is shocked to hear about this. And Tomar Rhys says, "Yeah, one day I'll have to tell you about some of the really big Green Lanterns." Which Arisia goes, "Oh? You're joking, right? That was just... wasn't it, Tomar Rhys? Wait." And so they leave.
Sentient planets.
Yeah, no, I love this story.
Yeah.
And of course, Mogo does sort of become a character who shows up once in a while. But this was his first appearance.
Right. I really like this, too. I've read it several times. I mean, it's one of the most well-known, I think, tales of the Green Lantern Corps backups, and it's definitely the one DC's gotten the most mileage out of. It's one of those stories that, once you know the twist at the end, it sort of takes a lot of the impact out of it on subsequent rereads, because it's all about the twist that Mogo is the planet. So it's more difficult to judge it once that's been spoiled for you. But I really do like it. Like seems to be the trend with a lot of these backups. I don't have any page by page. But I will say that it's a story that makes me both very happy to be a comic book fan, but also a little awkward at the same time. Because if you try to tell a non-comic book reader about a character who is a living planet that serves as a member of an intergalactic police force, they're going to look at you like you should be wearing a tinfoil hat. But it's just the type of creativity and imagination that I really, really love about comic books.
Yeah, okay. You said what I wanted to say. You took my note. No, I didn't have page by page notes, except for one where Bulfunga possessed the strength of a Debian dozer bull and the endurance of a Laotian lava limpet and the intelligence of a bed of kelp. It made me think of Lois and Clark. How dumb was she?
I just like the part, the intelligence of a bed of kelp. I'm going to use that someday.
Yeah. But I think I'm kind of had it similar of what Michael said. That was only partially joking. I don't think anybody – and you can say what you want about Alan Moore in the last few years, especially with all the Before Watchmen hoo-ha going on. But nobody thought on the
– always a little crazy.
Yeah, he's a little bit crazy, but he thinks on a scale that at this time – American writers weren't thinking on. And then this, you know, you kind of see others like Grant Morrison, Mark Millar coming in thinking of, you know, who would at that time would have thought of a smallpox virus being a Green Lantern beyond Alan Moore? But yeah, I mean, to kind of resonating what Michael said, nobody really was thinking about this at the time. This was something that would have just been, I mean, not just in comic books, but in, or even sci-fi, but in fiction in general. To think out this far outside the box and on this scale, it's one of those great comic book stories that I didn't think that people would have aneurysms reading this stuff, I would gladly hand to non-comic book fans to kind of convert them to the dark side here.
Well, not to throw cold water on that, but Jack Kirby did do the Living Planet thing back in 1966.
What?
With Ego the Living Planet and Thor. So.
Cool.
Who's Thor? Kidding. Yeah. I'm kidding.
He's so some guy.
It's not exactly a British thing or an Alan Moore thing. I mean, it had been done before. But yeah, I get the sentiment of what you're saying.
Yeah.
A couple of little things about this story, since we've pretty much covered the big broad strokes. It does occur to me on page one that with this book of Oa, the next time Jon Stewart's there, he could probably pretty easily figure out that Hal Jordan was the old Green Lantern. I mean, it's in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And other than that, yes, I really love this story. And, of course, Mogo does become somewhat important later on. I'm not sure how soon that happens, if that... But I think even during the Sinestro Corps War, he ended up having a bit of a role. And every once in a while, he'll act.
He'll usually send holograms. Like, he actually sent holograms to buy Lobo's space dolphins.
Interesting. But Mogo is one of those – is a character who's a planet. And it is one of those characters that nobody hates Mogo. There are people who love Mogo. There are plenty of them. There are people who are kind of indifferent to Mogo, like, it's a living planet. But nobody hates Mogo. You know why? Because Mogo doesn't socialize. It's true.
I think this might – not to change the subject, but I think this might actually be the first appearance of the Book of Oa, even though it's not actually called that in the story.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I think. I don't know for sure, but anyway, carry on.
All right. No, that's what I had.
There's going to be a lot that come out of – because this isn't the last time Alan Moore does a Green Lantern backup story. And there's a lot that gets drawn from – more from from Alan Moore's Green Lantern stuff, backup stuff, than any other. Especially when Geoff Johns takes over the book in the 2000s or the aughts. But obviously Mogo's a big part of that, and the Book of Oa is a huge part of that. And this is kind of this is a I don't want to say a milestone. This is a little bit of legacy. It's an important moment in the legacy of Green Lantern.
It introduces Mogo, so that's a very important part.
I'm actually taking a look because I do want to see if this is the first appearance of the Book of Oa.
I'm kind of looking too, and I can't find
188. Yep, this is it.
All right, there you go. All right, well, if I can get back to my notes here, there is a letters column in this. Particular issue, but nothing really jumped out at me. So we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back and talk about issue 189. In a world where planets die.
I have come to the conclusion Krypton is doomed.
Did I hear him right?
Where good and evil fight a never-ending battle.
But millions of people will die.
Millions! Once again, the press underestimates me.
One man will become a hero.
Every world needs its heroes, Clark. They inspire us to be better than we are. Protect us from the darkness that's just around the corner.
One man will rise to the challenge.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird!
It's a plane!
One man will wear spandex.
Well, one thing's for sure, nobody's gonna be looking at your face.
Mom?
Well, they don't call them tights for nothing.
Presenting The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, a podcast looking at the Man of Steel's history via his earliest adventures in comics, radio, and film. Featuring reviews, commentary, creator spotlights, and more. Join the adventure at GreatKrypton.com.
end, our final issue this episode is Green Lantern 189, with a cover date of June 1985, on sale March 21st, 1985, approximately. For 75 cents, you would have gotten a whopping 32 pages. This issue was written by Steve Englehart, penciled by Joe Staton, inked by Bruce Patterson, lettered by Helen Vesic, colored by Anthony Tolan, edited by Andrew Helfer, with a Joe Staton, Bruce Patterson cover. And this is Echoes, which is the at least the 17-page front portion is, which is actually the good part of the issue. So after his capture last issue, Sonar is breaking out of prison with two new accomplices, Blindside and Throttle, when John and Katma rush in to stop him. Blindside, with his lighting array, is momentarily able to stun the Green Lanterns, and they recover only to have Throttle, who has the ability to speed things up, at least things in motion from my understanding of what he's saying, start sending office supplies flying at them. Instinctively, John puts up a force field around he and Katma, but the typewriter gets caught in the inside the with him and bounces around, knocking them both on the head and knocking them clean out. The now free Sonar and his friends leave the GL since their rings would instinctively protect the unconscious heroes. Meanwhile, Hal and Carol continue the search for the Predator and in disgruntled former employees, and this brings them to the doorstep of Peter Grantland. Grantland is not happy to see Carol, and even less so when accusations are, well, implied. So he physically attacks Hal, who just beats the crap out of the guy, and Carol stops Hal from killing Grantland and searches Grantland's house as, well, the guy's laying bleeding on the pavement. Elsewhere, Katma and John have a talk following their defeat, and John learns the importance of the oath, even when it isn't spoken. And in the first of two interludes, Clay Kendall arrives at Ferris Aircraft, along with April O'Rourke, to resume his work, and Smith tells him that they have no place for a handicapped man at Ferris. And then Smith reports this to his superior, the Predator. In the second interlude, Sonar stands in the palace, in this palace. And his newfound allies explain that they broke him out of prison to team up with him and steal some riches. Throttle, along the way, mentions that Sonar will never believe where they got their powers. Sonar is reluctant to team up at first, but he sees the potential in an attack led by him, and that is where we leave that for the moment. Hal happens by the hospital where a vegetative Guy Gardner is, stops in for a visit, and along the way mentions that he is no longer Green Lantern. As Hal leaves, Guy seems to smile just a bit. John and Katma find that Sonar and friends are attacking Disneyland and rush to stop them. Throttle gets a momentary advantage when he speeds up Katma Tui's heart. And with his fellow Green Lantern held hostage, John has no choice but to leave when Sonar demands it, but not without a plan. John flies at light speed around the world so fast that he's able to punch Sonar and crew from behind in seconds. And with the danger over, John goes to check on Katma, and the two share a long kiss, which Katma Tui seems to understand the meaning of. And the issue kind of abruptly ends.
This was kind of a weird issue in a few different ways.
It was easy to synopsize, though.
Yes.
This happens. It's almost bullet points.
Yep. So for pages 1 through 3, I just thought to myself, what a weird bunch of villains. I mean, can't we get John someone worthwhile to fight soon, hopefully? I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. Page 4, this thing with the shielding kind of bugs me because they can do that skin-tight shielding and not just a sphere. But I would get it if John didn't figure that out quickly enough, but Katma Tui should have been able to. And I really do love that transition on page 4 to them going to leave the door, and then we transition to Hal and Carol meeting up with this character, Peter Grantland. But continuing on with that on page 5, even if this guy was innocent of theft when he was fired from Ferris Air, it's still clear that he's not somebody that you'd want to work with. He's got a bit of a temper.
Yeah.
And doesn't mind hitting women. So, yeah, he'd be fired one way or another, I'm pretty sure.
So he would go all jungle rage if he took the last jelly donut.
Exactly. The following page, Hal has broken rules and laws before. It's not like he's bound by law necessarily.
And so that's why he doesn't want to go into this guy's apartment to look for clues. But Carol's saying, well, I know that you're honor bound by that, but I'm not, so I'm going to go in. It just bugs me that Hal is such a paladin about it. I mean, he'll bend and break rules, especially when it's something like this. But oh well. Page 7, I really like the comment that John makes here about how the Green Lantern Ring is like something out of Arabian Nights. I just thought that was a cool moment.
Arabian Nights!
Yeah, don't ever do that. page 8, really cool conversation about the oath. I mean, of course John knows the oath, even though he did mess it up in two issues ago, but does it have the meaning to it that it does for so many other core members? He kind of still has to learn that. Like in the annual where everyone did it together, like a bonding thing. It matters. And maybe John's still at the point where it's just a necessary thing to get the ring charged. Pages 9 and 10, I dig the interlude titles. Because they're going from talking about the oath, and we have these two interludes that are not part of the main story. Well, the villain's part maybe is, but here we get a deal with Smith, and it's interlude Those Who Worship is the subtitle. And then the second one with the villains is Evil's Might. So I got a kick out of those titles. But on page 9, holy spit. They're right about the law against firing people that way. And isn't this guy a designer? Why wouldn't he be able to work about as well as he did before? It's just a very, very strange page, and they would absolutely win a lawsuit.
I'm hoping we get more on that in future issues, but I don't think we will.
Probably not, unfortunately. On page 11, on 12, we're finally bringing Guy Gardner into the mix, even though it doesn't look like he's going to be ready to do that much good just yet. But on page 12, you can bet your bottom dollar that Guy's mind was damaged. That never actually gets fixed. Just saying. Page 13, yet now that they know the bad guy's tricks, it really shouldn't be that hard at all for the Green Lanterns to take them down. I mean, they make the construct sunglasses to protect themselves from one guy's powers, and they know how to avoid the other one, except for the whole thing with Katma's heart being sped up. I guess they weren't quite ready for that. But it shouldn't be that hard for them to take these guys down at this point, because they each only have, like, one trick. And once you know what those are, you can easily go around them. But they tell John to go away, but I'm already thinking to myself, yeah, he'll be back, and probably faster than the speed of sound. So then you get to page 16. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Although it probably would have been even faster to double back in an arc and still hit them from behind. However, if he is actually going the speed of light, then that would be pretty fast anyway. I mean, he could go around the planet 7 times in a second if it were the speed of light. But pretty awesome ending, I thought, on page 17. But it's still a bad idea to date your mentor.
Just ask Obi-Wan. Oh, wait. That was simply implied.
He's not a Catholic priest.
The problem I have with the cover is that all the figures are the same size. There's no perspective because Katma's in the foreground and John's in the background, but they're all the same size. There's the layout and positioning are fine, but they just needed to tweak the size of the figures to give it more depth. Okay. On the brights, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I said okay because I just don't quite see it that way, but I guess I can see what you're seeing.
Okay, but on the bright side, I really like the splash page that opens the story. I thought that was a dynamic. It's nice to see Staten carrying on the Gibbons tradition, I guess you could call it, of dynamic opening splashes. Really, pages 2 through 4, this is really a great opening period. Well, up until John encases himself and Katma in a bubble, and the typewriter just keeps bouncing around, which was stupid. But pages 4 through 6, so they're just going to visit all of Carol's ex-boyfriends and hope one of them is the Predator.
They're ex-employees, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. The former employees of Ferris. to have, they would be disgruntled.
Oh, well, that's even worse. I mean, how many, given the sheer number of ex-employees that an airfield is likely to have, that's even worse.
Well, I think they're finding the ones that have serious problems, like this guy's temper.
Okay.
And ones that were actually caught doing something wrong. And in this case, this guy was caught stealing, even though he says that he was innocent. And you know what? Maybe he was, but it's still fine that he got fired because he's clearly got other emotional issues.
Right. When I read through it, it just seemed kind of random that they would just go visit this guy out of the blue. I didn't understand what made him so special, considering he'd never been seen before and we're never going to see him again.
He's a redheaded stepchild. It's special.
I guess. But on a related note, on page 6, I love how Hal's worried about illegally searching the guy's house without a warrant when he just got through with the totally legal activity of beating the man into unconsciousness. Page 7.
Well, that was defending. He was defending himself and Carol. And really, I have to wonder if it was legal for him to go through Ferris's personnel files.
Right. Yeah, and I understand what you're saying about defending, but when Carol has to call Hal off, I think there's a crosses from defending into assault. But
yeah, he's already unconscious. You're beating a dead horse.
Yeah. Page 7, both the art and dialogue on this page are very awkward. I like what Englehart's doing between John and Katma, but the dialogue here just comes off very stiff. And really, it's that way throughout the entire issue, but here on page 8, and it just came off kind of stiff to me. Page 9, taking Clay and April out of the book was a request from Len Wein, which we'll talk more about when we get to the letters page. And on page 10, again, the Predator comes off as a cartoon character. I like the way Wein wrote him much better. I mean, he was still silly, but here and in the Kupperberg issue, he just comes off as a character. And that's all I had. I think this issue is better than 188, but I'm just not completely digging Englehart yet. Like I said, maybe once he moves completely onto his own thing, it'll be better.
It's funny because I really preferred 188. I mean, I still like this one. I like all three of the ones for this episode.
Mm-hmm. And this is the maybe second or third episode in a row where I did enjoy all three of them. To varying extents.
I do like the idea that John is training with Katma and learning how to be more effective with the ring. And for the most part, I like the interaction between those two characters. And I like the idea of bringing Guy into the book, even though he's just a vegetable at this point. But so there's definite potential. There's just some weirdness that I'm not totally behind yet. But we'll get there, I think.
It got weird, didn't it? That leaves me. I want to take you on a time travel journey back to when this was sitting on stands at your local gas station or grocery store, and you come up to the spinner rack and you see this cover and you think to yourself, wait, didn't Green Lantern fight this guy last issue?
Yeah.
Just really, with somebody like Sonar, I mean, what a one-note character.
And didn't he go to jail at the end of the last issue?
Yes, he did.
And we start off, he's already been broken out.
Yeah.
But he's the master of sound.
Uh-huh. He's from a little country, and he's just trying to get some recognition for the country.
He's a master, all right. He's an ass master.
Come on. Page 2. I really, really want to make a Dazzler joke here about Blindside. But
you should put him on roller skates.
Yeah. But the problem is, and this may not be what he's using, but I know that they actually do use LED light technology in police enforcement, and they use it in the lights that they actually put on the car to disorient the character. They strobe a little bit differently, but I do think Blindside may be even lamer than Sonar, because basically it seems like he can use his powers for about 10 seconds and then he has to recharge for 10 seconds. So if this guy was coming up against the Flash, he's up the creek.
Yeah, pretty much.
If this guy was going up against anybody with any actual superpowers, he'd be in trouble.
Yeah.
Like, Superman would be fine. He'd be like, oh, I'm suddenly charged more.
Yeah, thanks for that. In fact, I really want to write that fanfic now. Page 3. Okay, the throttle can speed things up, and my understanding, at least by his explanation, is that things in motion, he can just increase their speed, and I can that's kind of applied to the heart, but I didn't take it as he can actually levitate him. I thought it was more of a pyro thing. Once it's in motion, he can speed it up, which is kind of cool. But here, he apparently picks things up with his mind, with mind bullets. And page four is, as Michael mentioned, why didn't John just make a solid bubble shield instead of a rubbery one?
That was Jeffrey, actually, but...
Oh, one of... Yeah. Typewriters are bouncing around. Make it a brick wall so the thing smashes. I get that it's inside there, but you can minimize the damage just by using common sense.
It's a very heavy-duty electric typewriter.
Well, those things, if it's a classic typewriter, you can easily brain somebody with those. I mean, even with like an electric IBM. Anyway, I don't know why I'm telling you my secrets. I like that the villains just kind of leave the Green Lanterns and not actually do anything, kind of a Dr. Evil thing. Like, you know, I'm sure there's something yellow around somewhere. Or, you know, just like we're going to assume they're fine and just kind of move on with our day.
Well, they say the lame henchman, Throttle and Sunbeam, what's his name?
Blindside. I like Sunbeam better, though. Or Sundrop.
they want to kill him, but Sonar says that they can't kill them as long as their rings still have power because it automatically protects them.
Yeah, but not against something yellow.
And I understand what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, and it seems like everybody knows that there's a yellow weakness to the ring.
Right.
Just get a baby chick. As Scott Gardner and Michael Bailey pointed out.
A marshmallow peep.
Yeah. Just stuff it up their nose and smother them with it.
No, like that Easter episode of South Park where they just took peeps and put them in the microwave. And that was how they blew up the house.
Page five. I'm not going to defend this obviously unbalanced man. But let's also look at this. Hal and Carol instigated. Now, I'm not saying that Carol deserved to get a beatdown. Well, no. I'm not going to go down that line of thought. But really, they came out of nowhere, show up at his house or his hotel room, and just start accusing him of things. Of being a supervillain, no less. There's slight implication there, enough that he could pick up on it. Now, admittedly, that would tick me off. And I'm not saying that I would start going, you know, jungle rage on them, but I would be a little ticked off. So they're kind of the instigator. However, Hal really basically just goes River City Ransom on the guy. You don't know where I've been, Lou. You don't know where I've been. page nine. Ouch. The way Smith treats April and Clay, the verbiage made me think about... I mean, in storytelling, sometimes if you're going to display bigotry and intolerance, even if it's a story against bigotry and intolerance, you know, sometimes it has to be shown. And I wonder if a line like this in today's ultra PC world would have actually, you know, if you would see this in the New 52 without slapping some sort of mature reader's tag on it.
Oh, I don't think you get a mature reader's tag.
I don't think so either.
It would definitely have been followed up on, or there would have been much outcry.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But, the internet would have.
But by the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation.
But the point is that Smith's a tool. Smith's an ass. And that's kind of the point, at least what I took away from the scene.
Well, at least people have reason to hate him now.
Well, true.
Exactly. Finally.
Okay. I think we got things out of order.
A little bit.
And on page 12, I'm sure nothing will come of this conversation with the vegetative Guy Gardner. Absolutely nothing at all.
Nope. We're never going to see Guy Gardner again.
No. Page 13.
Wait, yeah, we will.
It's called sarcasm, Jeffrey.
I know. I was being sarcastic back.
Wow. Doesn't that cancel out like waves of sound?
No, I don't think sarcasm works that way. But then again, I'm not a physicist.
There you go. Page 13, my only note was, insert obligatory I'm going to Disneyland joke here if nobody else does. And it turns out that...
You just got beaten by Sonar. What are you going to do next?
I'm going to Disneyland. And I enjoyed this quite a bit. It was, as I mentioned, it was really easy to synopsize. It felt like just a bunch of bullet points. And I'm kind of curious to get to the letters page when we get there to find out Because I didn't look at the letters page. I want to find out a little bit more about that. But
do you want me to go ahead and do it now? Because it ties into this story.
Yeah, let's tie it. Yeah, I do want to hear it.
Okay. In the letters by Lantern Light column, we get an editorial by, well, it's not signed, but presumably Bob Greenberger, because he was doing the letter column. But it apologizes for the reprint in 184, and he says that there were scheduling issues and promises that the story they chose, which was the first appearance of Guy Gardner, does tie into what's coming very soon, which I guess should be painfully obvious by this point. But it then talks about the creative team switchover, and it says, Steve and Joe felt the changes made by Len and Dave were good ones, yet more could be done, and in the coming months, you will be seeing things happen to everyone associated with this book. By the time the guys are done with Green Lantern, it will be a whole new ballgame and a new Green Lantern. And then it goes on to say that Len requested that he retain control over the destinies of characters he introduced to the strip. So the fate of Clay Kendall, April, and the much-ballyhooed Image will turn up in other DC titles, but Andy and I will keep you informed. Image was a character promoted in some of the fan press earlier that year. There was a blurb in an issue of Amazing Heroes, and I'll scan this and put it on the website in the show notes because there's actually a picture of the character. But apparently something was going to happen with that psionics chair that they introduced in issue 172 or 173, and those experiments were going to lead to Clay becoming a superhero known as the Image. And the letter column in 188 had a comment that readers should keep an eye on future issues of DC Comics Presents for the fates of Clay and April. But that story or stories never came to be, and Ween never dealt with the characters again, as far as I know. Clay does show up again down the road. I'm spacing on what issues those are at this precise moment, but
that would be during Reign of the Superman.
Is it really during Reign? Okay. So he shows up again just in time to...
to get obliterated.
Okay. But
wait,
anyway.
Wait, who does?
Clay Kendall is in Reign of the Superman when all of the bombs are coming down. He's the one on the
phone. Oh, you're right. Okay.
Now, he may actually have appearances.
I had never paid a huge amount of attention to who some of those characters were because I've actually got the first 40 or so issues of Green Lantern, but then of that series, which I guess would be Volume 3, but then I'm actually missing all the ones leading up to Reign of the Superman. Mm.
So anyway, Ween was going to turn Clay into a superhero, but then he left the book and said, I want to do it elsewhere, but then he never did. So that's why they were written out.
Well, we lost Clay and Heather. We saw Bruce leave. April, what'd I say?
Heather.
April. We saw Bruce leave. We have seen Rich die.
Right.
What happened to Mustache Man?
Jake? He's never seen again.
I know. He just
He shows up later. Much, much later. In Volume 3, but...
But everybody kind of has this little moment of goodbye, and Jake just... He's just around, apparently.
Maybe he actually quit Ferris and became the waiter from the issue we looked at last episode. Maybe that was him.
Comes full circle.
There you go.
He switched to a career in acting, which means he waits tables.
Is that all we had on the main story?
Yes.
Okay. This issue also had a 6-page backup story in the Tales of the Green Lantern Corps storyline, or backups, called Insect Trust, written and lettered by Todd Klein. Looks like art was done by Kevin O'Neill and colors by Anthony Tolan. And on the planet Zeos, it is harvest time, which is basically like gang warfare, with clans battling over crops like the sharks and the jets. As a huge melee is about to break out between these clans, the insect Green Lantern Zax shows up and dispels the crowd. Zax really isn't too popular on the planet and spends time kind of moping about how he has failed to stave off the effects of overpopulation and dwindling resources. And to make matters worse, the mechanical beings of the Spider Guild arrive and begin assimilating the planet's resources and people with their spider drones. Zax rushes out to stop the robo-spiders and begins chasing them off, pursuing them right into the jaws of a giant yellow trap. And with the Sector's Green Lantern captured, we end this backup story with a cliffhanger. I kid you not, that's all that happened. That is the shortest synopsis I've ever made. And, Jeffrey, did you have anything to say on this?
Okay, I have two notes. One is, oh, hey, it's Zax. And the other note is, I really don't care what happens in the next issue.
I kind of have a similar feeling where I just, I had no reaction to this story at all. What about you, Michael?
That's all Jeffrey had on it?
That's all I had.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it was all right, but I'm just, like you guys, I'm just not invested in it. And if I never read the second half, I probably wouldn't even remember that I didn't read the second half. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm noticing there's kind of a theme in a lot of these backups that they frequently center on the ineffectiveness of Green Lantern's power when it comes to the basic day-to-day politics of life.
That's not exactly their job, is the funny thing.
Yeah, yeah. But
I do get a kick out of the great big Green Lantern bug spray. Well, it's like a can of Green Lantern Raid.
Yeah.
I will say that I really do like the art, even though I didn't care for the story. It has
kind of a
2000 AD quality to it, or even a little bit of kind of sliding a little bit more towards Mike Mignola.
Kevin O'Neill, did he not do work for?
Touché.
2000 AD. He's the same artist that did the Stell storyline that I believe the Stell storyline that Jeffrey hated so much.
Not 200 AD, 2000.
Right.
Yeah, anyway. I'm pretty sure you did say 2000.
No, no, not him. I'm Google searching.
Okay.
I put in 200 AD, which doesn't pull up the same thing. Yes. Oh, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Okay.
But there you go.
Yeah. That pretty much says it all. Yeah. That kind of shows that Kevin O'Neill could do some great stuff if he's paired with a writer who has a good story.
Right.
Hey, and Lynn Wein was still the editor as far as when this story was at least produced. But yeah, I don't think any of us really have a lot to say on this one, which is kind of sad. We're supposed to be the analytical kind.
It's hard to analyze six pages where you can sum it up in a paragraph. So,
and did. Yeah.
Well, if we are done with that, Green Lantern made several appearances in other books released during the time period covered this episode. As we mentioned at the top of the show, John Stewart appears in Crisis on Infinite Earths, issues 1 through 3, and there's also a brief appearance of the Guardians in issue number 2. John has a full guest appearance in Blue Devil number 13. In a nutshell, John and Zatanna attempt to stop Blue Devil, who has been possessed by a demonic spirit, and Etrigan shows up and does something. That's it.
The end.
Hal Jordan has minor cameos and flashback scenes in Batman and the Outsiders number 22, Justice League of America number 239, and America versus the Justice Society number 4. And finally, as far as regular comics go, there is Omega Men number 26 and 27. The Green Man, who we saw in the backup from issue 172, appears in these issues and actually continues to appear throughout through the end of the title's run, because he eventually joins the team and resigns from the Green Lantern Corps. I haven't actually read these and I don't own them, but I think the Green Man appears in future issues of Green Lantern, so I'm sure we'll catch up with him in those. Have either of you read those, that Omega Men series?
No.
From this time? No? Okay.
I've read Omega Men from I have the first three issues, which includes the first appearance of Lobo.
Okay. But last but not least, there were issues 2 through 4 of Who's Who in the DC Universe, which included profiles of the Green Lantern villain Black Hand, as well as a Bizarro World profile, which included a Bizarro Hal Jordan called Yellow Lantern. And I will be sure to post those on the website in the Who's Who section, so be sure to check those out. I'll even post the Bizarro one, because Bizarro's awesome.
Bizarro is awesome, and yes. I think it's funny that a year from that, basically the whole Who's Who would have to be rewritten.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, they didn't plan that one too well. Anybody got any final comments on these three issues? Or the new creative team?
I really enjoyed all three of them. I'm looking forward to the next three.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, next
episode. Same here.
Next episode, we'll be looking at Green Lantern issues 190, 191, and 192. Also, be on the lookout sometime in the next couple weeks for a special episode where we will be looking at the DC Retroactive Green Lantern the 80s, a special issue that was published within the last year or so, but set during this era of the books. So, until then, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night,
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.